BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott-James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. 2 marks if they get the meaning of these words right. And we begin with Anne Scott-James. Anne, what is autoplasty?
Well, auto means self. Plasty has something to do with sculpture.
Yeah.
Particularly surgical sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's when you have a piece of your flesh grafted onto another piece of your body.
Sounds terribly uncomfortable, and you're dead right. 2 marks. Hank Miller, what is a necessitarian?
Well, in the 18th century, a necessary house was what they called a public convenience.
Mm.
So a necessitarian was somebody who was either in need of one or supported the theory of necessary houses or was the attendant therein. A penny for your thoughts, yes.
Well, not much help so far.
Philosophy.
Yes, that's more like it.
Some kind of philosophy.
It's somebody who denies free will and maintains that all actions of human beings are determined by previous causes. A fatalist, in fact. Dillis Powell, the meaning of exanimate, E-X-A-N-I-M-A-T-E.
Exanimate. Well, it used to be alive, but it isn't anymore.
Yes, that's good enough, too. Well done. 2 marks. Exanimate means dead or lacking in animation or spiritless. And it is a bit different, as Dillis quite rightly said, from inanimate, which means it never had any life at all, whereas this might have had one once, but died a bit. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is a polyclinic?
Well, it would be too much to hope that it was a hospital for parrots.
I'm terribly sorry, Dennis, but it would.
Poly in the sense of many.
No, that's
no,
what I was trying to warn you
all. City.
Yes, that's it.
Oh, a clinic for the city. It's yes, a clinic that does many purposes. It does not only do clinic, it does pressing.
I'll give you 1.5 because...
Pressing. Yeah.
One of the meanings of it is nowadays is outpatients department of a hospital, which is roughly what Dennis was saying.
Yeah.
But it started by being a clinic in a private house, not in a hospital, roughly a doctor's surgery where he did clinical work. Well, before we begin round 2... what I do is to give each team a quotation for them to write down, and then the 2 women members of the team will go on studying those quotations, because at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where the quotations come from. And Anne Scott-James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, "I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honour more." And Dillis Powell and Frank Miller, yours is, "Till death us do part." And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these came to be said or written. Well, round 2 is a round of odds and ends, really. 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott-James, who were the mum and dad of Romulus and Remus?
Well, the foster mother was a wolf.
Yes,
do I get something for that?
That's fair enough. I want some with 2 legs rather than 4.
Jupiter came into it somewhere.
It's a jolly good guess, and it's wrong.
Oh, no.
I'll give you 0.5 mark for knowing about the she-wolf. That's all right. But the actual parents, as they say, were Mars, the god of war, and the Vestal Virgin, Rhea Silvia. And, of course, being a Vestal Virgin, it oughtn't have happened to her. And, in fact, she was thrown into the Tiber a bit later on, but luckily bumped against the river god Tiberinus, who married her, so it was all right. Now, Frank Muir, who cut the Gordian knot and why?
one of those things like splitting the stone in half, wasn't it?
Yes.
If you could do it, therefore the whole world was yours.
Yes.
And you're a better man than I am. Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great cut it because he couldn't be bothered to untie it, so he sliced it through.
Yes. 2 marks it is. Dennis Powell, from whom did America get its name?
Somebody called America.
Not quite.
No, so
Amerigo.
Do you remember his surname?
No.
He's terribly friendly.
No, we were in very intimate terms. I never learned his surname.
One and a half, I think, for Dennis being on such intimate terms. He was a chap called Amerigo Vespucci, who was a navigator and explorer. There's some doubt as to whether he did, in fact, discover the mainland of America, but he wrote about it all the rest of his life and said he did. It's in the 15th century. Dennis Norden, where would you expect to find elephants a-piling teak in the sludgy, squidgy creek?
On the green release of the Limpopo River.
That's a jolly good shot, Dennis. You've got it wrong, but I mean...
On the greasy Limpopo River.
Dennis, it's verse and not prose, and you've been there before. Funny things happen to the dawn.
Oh, it comes up like thunder.
Yes.
On the road to Mandalay, yeah.
Yes. Again, 1.5, because I gave quite a lot of help. Well, the next round's about verse and poetry. What I do is to give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to finish it off for the next line or so. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more if they can name its source. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Shakespeare was of us, Milton was for us, Burns, Shelley were with us. They watch from their graves. He alone breaks from the van and the free man.
Is it just for a handful of silver he left us, just for a ribbon to wear? It's Browning.
Yes.
The lost leader.
Yeah. Shakespeare was of us, Milton was for us, Burns, Shelley were with us. They watch from their graves. He alone breaks from the van and the free man. He alone sinks to the rear and the slaves. 3.5. Frank Muir. The angels not so happy in heaven went envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know, in this kingdom by the sea.
Is it?
I think your partner's probably got it.
Annabel Lee. Sweet Annabel Lee.
Mm. Isn't that sweet?
Mm. Annabel Lee.
Yes.
Annabel Lee, Jag.
Yes, absolutely right.
It's a poem, the title of which is Annabel Lee.
Yes. An author? Yes.
Edgar Allan Poe.
I don't think I can get the next 2 lines, so I'll give you 3. Edgar Allan Poe's Annabel Lee, the angels not so happy in heaven went envying her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know, in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud one night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. It sounds like a sort of deep freeze. It's a rather curious poem. 3 out of 4. Dennis Powell, I chatter over stony ways in little sharps and trebles. I bubble into eddying bays.
It's Tennyson.
Yes.
And it's the brook.
Yes.
And
I babble on the pebbles.
That's it. Got it absolutely right. You get your 4 marks. Dennis Norden, this is very difficult to read, but I'll try, Dennis. Our daughters with base-born babies have wandered away in their shame. If your missus had slept, squire, where they did...
Your missus would not have a name. I really don't know this. I don't know what pantomime it comes from.
It's in some of the better anthologies, but I agree it's rather pantomime stuff. One for a good last line, Dennis. Not quite as Charles Kingsley intended. It's a poem called The Bad Squire, and it goes on and on. Our daughters with base-born babies have wandered away in their shame. If your missus had stepped, squire, where they did, your missus might do the same. And now a round of origins and derivations. At 3 marks, if members of the teams can define the present meaning first, and then give me the origin and derivation of these words or expressions or phrases. Anne Scott James, cordon bleu.
Well, currently it means a crack cook.
Yes.
Crack cook.
I should think the blue ribbon, it's like Anis Joaquim Malipon.
Yes,
I think it's sort of an early form of the garter in France.
I mean,
a sash, the blue sash that a...
The later form of the garter is the
suspender
belt.
That is an honour in France. Kings of France used to give cordon bleu to...
It's now a compliment to a chef or cook who has really become terribly expert. But in France, there was an order of Saint-Esprit, the order of the Holy Ghost, and a knight who became a member of this order wore the blue ribbon, which was the sign of the decoration. It was at one time the highest knightly order in France. Frank Muir, publican.
Publican means the man who runs a pub.
Mm-hmm.
Or a licensee.
Yes.
Because he has to get a license to do things.
And originally?
Are we back in antiquity?
Back in the New Testament, if you like.
Yes.
Yes.
Scribes, Pharisees.
Yes.
And publicans.
Mm. What were they doing?
What were they doing? What were they up to?
Mm-hmm.
Money changing?
You're getting there.
Ah. Money changing.
Not quite. It's to do with money, but not...
Money.
Tax
changing.
In the front. Tax what?
Tax.
Tax collecting. Tax collectors, publicus.
Two and a half, I hope.
Public houses.
Publican nowadays, the chap who runs a public house, but originally they were the people who were answerable and responsible to the master tax collector who lived in Rome, and these were tax collectors, or better, tax farmers, because they made quite a lot out of it themselves on the side, and often became more or less millionaires, and they were the people who were called publicans. It's very difficult to know why the term shifted from being a tax gatherer, who's not a very popular character, to a chap who's supposed to be the rubicund and cheerful master of a pub. Now to this pearl. To measure swords with someone or to take someone's measure?
Well, it means nowadays to see how... to take someone's measure means to see how good they are.
Mm-hmm.
It must have come from fencing, I should have thought.
And what did you do?
Well, when you started,
you made sure his wasn't longer than yours.
Exactly. You
the old joke.
You might have been using a lance.
3 marks. Nowadays, measuring sword with somebody means trying to find out whether somebody is strong enough to match himself against you with any chance of success. But this was the job which the seconds in a duel had. In order to prevent unfairness, they measured the two swords so that one wasn't conspicuously 2 or 3 feet longer than the other, which would have been pretty unfair to the other chap who hadn't got it.
What did they do with pistols?
I don't know about that. I think you were stood at a distance. It didn't matter all that much if one had a longer barrel.
Well, it did to one person.
Especially if the other one had a sword.
Now, Dennis Norden, what does the expression a king log or king log mean?
King log? Oh, that's one of these obscure fables, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
With frogs come into it somewhere.
They do?
It's a fable. A king log is a... I should think is something that looks like a king, but is actually inert and incapable of doing anything.
Yes.
And it comes from some rotten fable. I don't know whose it is.
1.5. King Log is somebody who rules or manages something quietly or peaceably without making his power or authority too conspicuously felt. And there was a fable of the frogs wanted a king, and they asked the king of the gods, Zeus, for a king to rule over them. He just threw down a log, and as Dennis said, this didn't give them very much excitement. I mean, they just lay about there. So that they grumbled a lot at having a king who did so little work. So next time, Zeus sent them down a stork, and the stork ate them all up.
Something thing. You put them in, you get them out.
And now we come to the last round. I'll go back to those 2 quotations I gave the teams earlier in the program. For 2 marks, Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of the quotation, I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honour more?
Well, it's an ode or lyric
mm-hmm.
by Lovelace.
Yes. Richard Lovelace, the Cavalier poet, to Lucasta on going to the wars, I could not love thee, dear, so much, love I not honour more. Now, Dennis Powell, will you give me the origin of your quotation, till death us do part?
It occurs in the marriage service.
Yes, 2 marks. And now I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. So, back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honour more.
I once had a very exhausting experience with a tall girl. The girl's name was Kit. I met her when I was living in Yorkshire and I was a member of the Ilkley Moor Lawn Tennis Club. And she was the girls' singles champion. She'd been single longer than any other girl in the club, you see, simply because of her height. She was 6'8". It really looked as if love would pass Kit by, except that she had this great stroke of luck. She sprained her ankle when she was vaulting the net. And I must point out that with that height, the net she used to vault was the one that went round the court. And because of this unfortunate accident, this sprain, she had to use a wheelchair. And it was while she was doing the pier bill, she was in the wheelchair, that Rodney Carfax applied for membership of the club. He was, of course, immediately accepted because we, at that time, were rather short of players who could serve overarm. But the moment Rodney came in and saw Kit sitting in the chair, that was it, you know. And all through the ensuing Yorkshire area championships, they were inseparable. So while I was on the court, I went over to Kit and I said, is there anything between you? Because I was curious, because he was 4'5". You know, and so one does ask, you know, is there anything between you? And her face sort of clouded over, and she said, yes, 2'3". I said, well, obviously he doesn't mind that. She said, he doesn't know. So I said, well, what do you mean? She said, he hasn't yet seen me standing up. I said, well, that's awkward. Which, of course, it is. And I said to her, do you think that he's serious? And she said, yes, he's very serious. He told me that as soon as I can go back on my feet, he wants to take me for a walk over Ilkley Moor and propose. And I said, well, when will that be? And she said, well, I'm just sort of spinning it out. She said, he's beginning to wonder a bit, you know, how a sprained ankle can go on for 5 months. I said, that's terrible, because she was obviously very fond of him. I said, wait a minute. I said, tonight is a moonless night, isn't it? I tell you what you do. When he comes off court, you tell him that the surgeon is going to take the cold compress off this afternoon and that you will meet him over on Ilkley Moor at 10 o'clock, which he did. And you know what I did? I conscripted the whole of the tennis club and we went out to the moor and we dug a trench. We dug a trench 1/4 mile long and exactly 2'3" deep. And when Rodney arrived at 10 o'clock, she was standing in it. And he kissed her. He only had to lean forward, not up, and took her hand, and they walked off together into the night. And thanks to the darkness, you see, he couldn't perceive that she was actually, as it were, 1 floor below. Now, you may say, well, he was bound to find out eventually. He did. But he only found out because she confessed But she confessed in such a poetic way that he forgave her, and they're still happily married now. Because in the middle of a caress, she suddenly stopped and said to him, "You could not love me, dear, so much. Loved I not on a moor?"
And I was so afraid it wasn't going to have a happy ending. Well, now we come back to Frank Muir, and if you remember, his quotation was, "Till death us do part."
The Victorians had a saying, "Every picture tells a story." And I've often wondered whether the stories that we've given these paintings were in fact what was intended. So I've started some investigations. I'm very revealing they've been, not to say riveting. You know that one in the Tate Gallery? It's the one of the naval scene of the engagement off Tenerife in 1802. There are the ships of the line, and there's this longboat being rowed by this rather stout girl. And there's the young naval captain, and he's clasping her, and shot and shell is about to sink the boat. And the title of the picture is, "Till Death Us Do Part." Terribly romantic. Well, I made some investigations, and that isn't, in fact, the story of that picture at all. It isn't romantic, but it's a story of steadfast duty. I researched this. It took me a long time at the Maritime Museum in Greenwich. And the people in this story consisted of Captain Horatio Wilson, who was one of the youngest captains in the British Navy in 1802. His nickname was Tim. Apparently, at the third pip, he was... at the third pip, he was 12, precisely. They were always very much younger in those days. By the time he was about 19, he was in command of a frigate of the line. Now, the girl in the boat, apparently his friend, was called Emma Hambleton. Now, Emma Hambleton was employed on the ship. They used to in those days. The captains used to have their girlfriends and wives aboard. And she was employed to holy stone down the deck. There was also on board the frigate a very dim powder monkey called Sid, whom I'll come to later. Now, not actually on this ship, but in this story, there was the Rear Admiral Shovel, a relation of the famous Sir Cloudesley Shovel. And Rear Admiral Shovel's job was to command the first ship in the line. And Admiral Nelson comes into it a bit later. Now, what happened was, in this engagement in the Azores, Captain Horatio Wilson, our hero, commanded the last boat in the line, and he had Lord Nelson on board with him. And at one critical stage, just as the French fleet were coming alongside, Nelson rapped out, he was much younger, he was 5. he turned round to Captain Horatio Wilson and said, "Make a signal to Sir Cloudesley Shovel in the leading vessel. Turn to port." Now, this presented Captain Horatio Wilson with a dilemma, because he knew that Nelson didn't. That in fact, Rear Admiral Shovel was deaf. And this had come about because on an inspection of Wilson's ship some week earlier, the usual Admiral's inspection, he got a twinge of gout in his larboard leg, and he'd asked to see the surgeon, Surgeon Commander Farr. And so they called for this dim powder monkey, Sid, Wilson did, and said, "Where's Surgeon Commander Farr?" And Sid, the dim powder monkey, paled and said, "I've shoved him up the barrel of one of the guns." So Captain Wilson said, "Why did you do that?" And Sid said, "Well, you said, shove the ammo up the gun." Whereupon the Rear Admiral Shovel put his head near the gun, looked in the barrel and shouted, "Far!" Whereupon the dim powder monkey, Sid, applied match to taper, so Rear Admiral Shuttle was deaf. So consequently, when Nelson said, make a signal to him to turn to port, Captain Horatio Wilson ordered the longboat to be lowered. Now, he couldn't row, but he knew Emma Hamilton, this rather stout girl, was a very good rower. So he commanded her into the boat and said, row forwards towards the front of the fleet. Because as he rowed, the French fleet closed up, peppered him with shot and shell. The little longboat started to sink. And he clasped Emma in his arms, hoping that she would swim ashore with him. That's why. So what he was shouting out in this brave way, as depicted in this picture, was not this romantic, till death us do part. He was shouting to that forward ship, tell deaf ears to port!
Well, frankly, I'll never dare visit Greenwich again after that one. By your vote, Dennis Norton wins the contest of the two stories, but nevertheless, the team of Dillis Powell and Frank Muir win the complete contest. And that also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶